WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, on yesterday's show, New York City Schools Chancellor Richard Carranza made a promise to a certain group of families. As the school year gets ready to kick off tomorrow, your child's gifted and talented program will not be kicked out.
We are going to look at, with a very critical lens, what is it that we're doing for our gifted students, but that's not going to happen tomorrow, and it's not going to happen next week. It's not going to end the program this year. That's just not an enlightened way of going about policy development.
Now, the reason for the chancellor's reassurance is that Mayor de Blasio's School Diversity Task Force recommended last week that the current system of gifted and talented programs and gifted and talented testing be abolished. Here's one example of why. In a New York Times article about the proposals today, it says thousands of parents are preparing at great expense for this winter's kindergarten GNT entrance exam, a high-stakes test for four-year-olds. It says one center located on Manhattan's Park Avenue advertises early test preparation for children as young as 18 months, followed by as many as 16 tutoring sessions for the kindergarten gifted exam at a cost of up to $4,000. Now, the truth is, almost everyone of all political stripes thinks that single test admission system, the one for four-year-olds, is ridiculous and biased. The chancellor put it this way.
What we're trying to really be focused on is how do you truly identify the intellectually gifted child, and how do you parse out the effects of economic privilege from true giftedness?
Even the conservative Manhattan Institute think tank, which seems to exist to denounce the current integration efforts as a tax on excellence, says the tests for four-year-olds are unnecessary. And beyond that, Chancellor Carranza is skeptical of the content for the kids who we label GNT.
I've gone around the city. You can't point to a specific pedagogy or a specific curriculum. It's just faster and more. That can't be what gifted and talented is in the biggest school system in the nation.
So some thoughts from New York City Schools Chancellor Richard Carranza from yesterday's show, if you missed it. Now we're very pleased to welcome back Maya Wiley, head of the Mayor's School Diversity Task Force. She is also Senior Vice President for Social Justice and a Professor of Urban Policy and Management at the New School, has previously been Chief Counsel to Mayor de Blasio and head of the Civilian Complaint Review Board, and is an NBC News and MSNBC legal analyst. Maya, we really appreciate it. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's good to be here, Brian.
The basic stats that I read are that New York City public school students are about 70% Black and Latino, but the GNT population is only 25% Black and Latino. That stat itself says they're testing for something that's learned rather than any kind of inherent gifts or talent. Are those approximately the numbers?
Those are approximately the numbers. And, you know, I think when one of the things that I think is important for us to underscore is that the School Diversity Advisory Group, that I'm one of three co-chairs of, just to
co-chair,
be clear.
Co-chair.
I am a co-chair and of a very, very active group of parents and educators and academics. What we saw in the research demonstrates why we have such abysmal numbers. But it's not because we don't support gifted programs. I think the unfortunate thing about how this whole discussion got launched was missing that what we want is more, more. We want expansion, but we want expansion of what works. And the numbers that you're identifying, Brian, is one of the indicators that what we're doing doesn't work. Because what we're actually doing is saying, if you have the resources to advance your child, you will have more of a likelihood of getting placed in a program. What we're saying is, first of all, not even the experts who created gifted and talented programs think the way New York City is doing this is right. We should start there. What we want are working programs that are research-based and that expand gifted opportunities for gifted kids. But one of the things that that means that's also gotten lost in this debate is it means more advanced learning opportunities in all schools. Because there are school children right now who are Black and Latino and Asian and white who are ready for accelerated learning and they're not getting it. That's not the same as a gifted and talented program.
Explain that. What's the difference between a gifted and talented program and accelerated learning?
It goes back to something that the chancellor said that you just played back from the interview yesterday. We have this label, and so we assume that the label means that there's some curriculum behind it that accelerates the learning of kids in the program, meaning if I'm 2 years ahead of grade level on math, if I'm in a gifted program, I must be getting 2 years ahead in terms of what the content of the math I'm getting. That's what acceleration is, but that's not what our gifted and talented programs are. So what, in fact, there's a University of Connecticut study that came out earlier this year that was fascinating. They looked at three states that have gifted and talented programs that are mandated, meaning, you know, you have to, they're literally embedded in state law. And they surveyed 2,000 elementary schools about the content of their gifted and talented curriculum. And what they found is out of a list of 26 items, accelerated learning was number 18 on the list. What they were really doing was just corralling kids in a classroom and sometimes giving them a little bit more opportunity for brainstorming or a little bit more opportunity for debate. But the curriculum really was not any different from what kids in regular classrooms were getting. But it was getting labeled as if there was something special. Mm. And that's actually exactly what the chancellor was talking about here in New York City. So we've become very attached to a name without, it's like driving a car without looking under the hood. We're not looking under the hood.
So in that particular clip of the chancellor that I played where he said, as I've gone around the city, you can't point to a specific pedagogy or a specific curriculum. It's just faster and more.
Sometimes it's inferior and bad. I mean, the part of what we have to do is say there is no uniform thing that we call gifted and talented in New York City. There are schools that may be doing incredible things with advanced learning. So I'm not suggesting that what I'm saying applies to every single program. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the point. Mm-hmm. It's so varied. We have concerns. We have parents who are in our group from, say, District 16, Bed-Stuy, that say, you know, we fought for more gifted and talented programs. What we got is not quality. So it's not just having the label, and it's not just having a high-stakes test. Experts in gifted and talented say multiple measures. Use multiple measures to assess. And what we said in our report is that is not what we're doing, and that's what we should move away from.
Multiple measures to assess. So when the chancellor says what we're trying to be really focused on is how do you truly identify gifted children and how do you parse the effects of economic privilege from true giftedness, is it possible to parse?
It is. Well, so there's a debate in the research. You know, one of the things that people are saying is, well, you're not being specific. And I think what we're saying is, right, we're pulling from the research and we're saying the research says a couple of very important things. Number one, it says what we're calling gifted and talented often doesn't have content behind it. The way we're assessing is not appropriate. And what we have to do then is think about two things. One, we have to assess in a more fair way. That means multiple measures. We should not be assessing, we should not be having 3- and 4-year-olds preparing for a high-stakes 2-part test where they have to walk into a building, be escorted away from their parents, and then essentially be told, you know, answer these questions. there's really no expert that thinks that makes sense. But there are even questions about how we're assessing for third grade. But the other piece of it that we're trying to point to right now is that if you are a Black or Latino student in many of the districts in the city that are segregated, right, that are high concentrations of low-income kids, you are more likely to be in an overcrowded classroom. You are more likely to be taught by teachers who may not have the supports they need to teach the content they're teaching you. And you may have students that who are absolutely have the interest and the propensity to apply themselves to something, and they've never been given the opportunity. So it's not just having multiple measures of assessment, it's creating more of that kind of opportunity of finding and resourcing the gifts and talents in students whose parents can't pay for it outside of the school. Because that's the other thing we're doing in our current system. We're rewarding those who either scrape together resources that they don't really have, or who have resources they can apply to getting those oboe lessons, to getting those piano lessons, to having an art class outside of school on a Saturday, to having a math tutor. That's not what low-income kids of color are having the opportunity to develop their interests, their gifts, and their talents, and then we're just testing them.
So, listeners, we invite your questions for Maya Wiley, co-chair of the Mayor's School Diversity Task Force, on the role and nature of gifted and talented programs and testing for them and assessment for them and school integration generally, because that's a larger context here. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Teachers, anybody who currently teaches what you call G&T or has done so in the past, I realize school is in today for teachers, even though it doesn't start for the kids until tomorrow. So if there are current gifted and talented teachers from classes that are not in session, maybe other school districts that are not in yet, feel free to give us a call. Or if you're retired from that field, maybe you're out there today, or parents or students and former students, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I think one of your central messages here so far is that the debate that's taken off publicly around your proposal is kind of missing the point and is being argued on the basis of red herrings.
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's being argued on the basis of headline rather than the substance that's in the report. And I think one of the things that we were very humble about is we think that we should be inciting innovation, and that we as the School Diversity Advisory Group don't have all the innovations. So what we tried to do is say, here's the research that says this doesn't work. So let's stop doing that. And here is the research that shows really promising opportunities for expanding advanced learning for more kids and creating ways of assessing it more fairly.
You're saying expanding. You use the word more before. The headlines are talking about abolition.
Right. Well, let's be clear So to the extent, we had a big debate with the New York Times about their headline, by the way.
What was their word? Was it eliminate?
Eliminate. And they're technically accurate. So it's not that the headline was inaccurate. It's that it leads to misunderstanding about the recommendation. So it goes back to labels versus substance. So what the Bloomberg era did for gifted and talented was essentially to shrink opportunity for kids. Actually, in 2008, there was a cutting in half of the number of gifted and talented seats. But secondly, it actually accelerated segregation. We saw a drop, for instance, a lot of people have been talking about the pipeline for specialized high schools. This is a set of recommendations around that pipeline, by the way. So for all those people calling for attention on pipeline, that's what we paid attention to. But that pipeline was shut off because what the Bloomberg administration did was essentially take high-stakes testing, put it on steroids, rather than thinking about how we expand enrichment, how we expand opportunity, and how we create more seats. So what we're really saying is end the Bloomberg era version of gifted and talented, and let's create the 21st century version, and the version that also says outside of anything that's labeled, when we don't like the label because for cultural reasons, but well, but at the end of the day, I don't care what you call it. Mm-hmm. Call it whatever you want, but make sure what we're doing is leading to the goals that the chancellor and the mayor did adopt in our first report, which were goals around whether we look like the city of New York.
As a historical point of reference, I've seen the Bloomberg program described as roughly that he and his chancellors expanded the number of gifted and talented programs, and it was a sincere effort to increase integration, but it backfired. Do you see
right.
it that way?
Well, I think there's a debate about this, but what I see is, I do think personally that the intent of what the Bloomberg administration did was not to segregate and was to increase proficiency. The reality, because remember, one of the things that was what turned out to be untrue is that the Bloomberg administration said, oh, look, we've actually greatly expanded Black and Latino achievement with the way we have now done gifted and talented, with some of the changes that we have made. It turns out that was not true. And that if you looked at the national scores, you had seen no improvement in closing what the chancellor would call the opportunity gap between Black and Latino students, which is their reading proficiency and math proficiency. And that's because we were looking at testing, and we were looking at a name of a program and not looking underneath the hood at the substance.
Again, listeners, we can take some phone calls from Maya Wiley. If you want to push back on this, feel free. Maybe some parents of students who are in or have recently been in programs labeled gifted and talented in the New York City public schools. Do you get, because a lot of this report and a lot of what the chancellor was saying here yesterday is a critique of the content of what we label G&T and what the kids actually get. So can you describe what your child's gifted and talented program consisted of differently from so-called regular classes, and why your student benefited from it? Who wants to say something in defense of these programs at all, or ask Maya Wiley, co-chair of the mayor's panel on Task Force on School Diversity, a question? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Maybe it's because of the Times headline that you were referring to before, but the Times published a group of letters to the editor the other day, each of which knocked your proposal. And I want to read a couple of excerpts and get your reactions, because mm-hmm. these are reflective of the critiques that I'm hearing from critics mm-hmm. out there. So one writer said, in the first one published in the set, our goal as a city should be improving our schools so that every student is educated to his or her maximum potential. Instead, our mediocre mayor and do-nothing chancellor want to ignore the needs of hundreds of thousands of bright kids of all races and backgrounds and embrace mediocrity in the name of integration and politics. Your response.
And I read that letter. Our response is we agree with the point that we should be expanding opportunities throughout the system, and that's actually what we recommended. So we're actually in agreement with what that letter writer is saying. It's actually part of what we recommended was more in more schools and not mediocrity. That's why we're pointing to the research. We're pointing to the folks. There are school districts around this country who are doing what we have recommended right now and seeing improvements as a result. We're also seeing, you know, the Public Good Project actually studied schools that were racially diverse that ended their labeled gifted and talented and in favor of creating more enriched learning, and those schools are thrilled. And so what we're saying is exactly that. What we should be willing to do is look at the program, not the label, and look at the opportunity, not, you know, just be worried because we're in agreement.
You know, I was wondering why nobody was calling in on this, which would normally light up the board without any prompting. And so now I've been told that our call-in number is actually not working right now.
No.
So for those of you who are trying to call, we apologize that you're getting whatever you're getting on your end. And for the moment, what we can take is tweets. So that if you're on Twitter, and some people have done this already, So I will read a couple of tweets that have come in, but you can tweet a question for Maya Wiley at Brian Lehrer, just at Brian Lehrer on Twitter. So here's one from somebody who writes, gifted and talented programs are racist. I was in one, PS 11, in the 80s, and it was all white in a school of almost all minority in the main school. How much is that at the heart of this? And the word, the R word needs to be spoken.
I'm really sad to say that some of the responses, whether on social media or otherwise, that some of our members have received, I can only describe as racist. I can only describe as a deep-seated belief that Black and Latino students are simply inferior. And I think part of our concern with the way we think about these programs and the way that we assess and support gifts and talents have actually advanced those kinds of stereotypes. And I think that that experience is a very real one in our system. It's not the only one, and we're not suggesting it is the only one, but we are suggesting that we have to take a real hard look at what we're actually doing and why we're doing it.
Another of the letters to the editor to the Times says, in part, if this advice takes root, the whooshing you hear will be the sound of parental funding of supplemental programs being withdrawn, and yes, there will be a stampede to the suburbs. It has happened before. And from what I gather, your report acknowledges that there could be some white flight and Asian flight from the school system if your proposal is accepted?
What we said is that's not what we're trying to do, and that we're threading the needle between creating a fairer system and creating what is one of the good things about what's happening in the New York City school system, which more white and affluent families are opting in. We don't want to lose that. And one of the reasons we made our proposals the way we did was based on, say, San Antonio. San Antonio is a school district where it was largely Latino and some Black. White and middle-class families had fled the system. They had a shrinking student population. What they did was what we are recommending. They created enriched programs like dual language learning, like advanced arts, and they located it in schools where they saw the opportunity to create more integration. And what that produced was more white and affluent parents coming into the system. That's what we're recommending. We're actually recommending a win-win. I think what has been so important is to try to open up this conversation in a way that engages people to look at what the rest of the country is doing and learning, and what we in New York City are behind the times on. That's Washington, D.C. That's Montgomery County. That's Chicago, Illinois. That's San Antonio, Texas. We are not at the leading edge of this. And if we understand that we agree that more of our students, including our white students, should be challenged in school, I think what we've done is identified a way for us to develop a collective sense of what works.
You are Senior Vice President for Social Justice and a professor at the New School.
I am.
Let me read from a Times article from last year. It says, a new analysis from the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School looks at student performance on a single test, the state math assessment given in 2016 to third through fifth graders. At each school, it looks at the race of the test takers and estimates their household income using census information about where they live. And the conclusion is almost all students in the study with estimated household incomes below $30,000 were Black or Hispanic, while students with household incomes above $80,000 were predominantly white. And the poorer students were, the lower they tended to score on the test, even when they went to the same school as wealthier children. What does that study tell you, if anything, about the challenges for actually improving the outcomes for low-income Black and Latino students, even in an integrated environment?
A couple of things. And one is that, and what we have said repeatedly, both in our first report and our second report, paying attention to educators around what supports and resources are needed to implement well. That's one of the reasons why our recommendation was to pilot and also to resource and to engage stakeholders, so that we were actually using and figuring out what would work in our schools, and to scale that up in a smart way and in a supported way. Nothing in our report was suggesting all this has to change tomorrow. Our report was looking very specifically at a scaling model, and one that also supported and resourced more ideas. We never in our report thought that we were proposing all the ideas. What we said is, here are ones that are clear and supported by research, and we should be innovating more. So engaging educators, resourcing it appropriately, and figuring out what those resources are. One of our recommendations that is not getting attention is to create a group that would study the ways to assess and support pedagogically the kinds of classrooms we're trying to create, because we do believe that we should do more looking at that.
And the article, that same article, on that same study, makes a politically challenging assertion that there were schools that did defy the study's overall trends. Those from the Success Academy Charter Network, which has significantly outperformed district schools on state tests, did so again, showing extremely high test scores for its students who are mostly poor minorities. What's the lesson from that?
Well, I think we have to know more about what's underneath that. I mean, one of the important things about studies and one of the important things about looking at multiple studies is to try to understand what's at work. One of the things that we said very clearly in our report is we should not disrupt anything that's meeting the goals we proposed in the first report and anything that's working for vulnerable students. In that sense, our recommendations were very balanced around, we're not trying to throw out the baby with the bathwater. We're trying to preserve some of our successes. We're trying to invite people into a conversation about what additional ideas exist and how to properly resource and support this in a way that ensures implementation success. Because there's no question, if we give educators unfunded mandates, and this happened in the Bloomberg era, big pressures to produce on test scores overnight, what we will see is failure, because we haven't supported success. And we believe we should go through a process of understanding what the appropriate supports for that success are.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. We're finishing up with Maya Wiley, co-chair of Mayor de Blasio's School Diversity Task Force, on the new conversation that this task force has started in the city over the last week on gifted and talented programs and maximizing the potential for every child. Just on the sort of biggest possible picture of the achievement gap, the racial achievement gap, and how stubborn it's been. One more Times article from last fall says that when the New York State Board of Regents met last month, the mood was despondent. Quote, the needle hasn't moved for minority children in decades, said Regent Kathy Cashin, and it goes on from there. And I'm thinking of like a 50 years timeline. In the 1960s, local control was the movement to help close the gap, but eventually the 32 separate school board system was seen as ineffective and corrupt, and the new mantra became the opposite, mayoral control, central control for accountability. And that didn't change it. There was the rainbow curriculum under Dinkins, No Child Left Behind under Bush and Ted Kennedy, the Common Core under Obama, which went from, you know, progressive way to educate all kids equally to something seen as stifling creativity and individuality. It seems like every generation of politician, local and national, comes in with a plan to close the achievement gap, and one by one they get discredited because they fail.
Brian, you know, I'm sitting here as a black woman who's 55 years old, who went to a segregated elementary school that was all black, and frankly, vast majority of those kids were unable to get enough food to eat throughout the month. Okay? So what I'm telling you right now is what we have never done in this country is confront integration appropriately. And we keep wringing our hands about, oh, we haven't solved this achievement gap, when we have seen an increase in racial segregation of schools over the last three decades. We've seen an expansion. When every effort to say we learn better when we learn together, when every research report suggests that it's both in the interests of our critical thinking skills, in the interests of our national security, in the interests of our social cohesion, that we actually learn together, that's what we have never done. And if you look at the research, if you are Black and Latino, just on class size, because if we look at where our overcrowding is happening, it's most devastating in Black and Latino districts in this city. If you are Black and Latino, your academic gains are twice as high if you are in a small, if you get a reduced class size than if you're white. What that means is it is critically important, more so for Black and Latino students than for white students, in order to gain on performance. Have we done that? That's been a big challenge. But as long as we have districts that say, you know, we're going to shut our doors to people who do not live in our district, as long as we say we're going to build walls, not gateways, then we are not going to solve the problem. But the issue here isn't whether it's intractable. It's about whether we believe in each other and whether we're willing to confront what it takes and what fear we have to overcome to fix our schools for all our kids. Because the one last thing I'll say about this, Brian, being a university professor, literally some of the researchers saying as many as a third of our college entrants in higher education suffer from anxiety. I want to ask every parent who's listening, what do you think standardized tests that actually aren't really measuring what they're supposed to measure, how do you think those are contributing to your kids' anxiety? We're doing it wrong, and it doesn't help white students, and it certainly doesn't help Black, Latino, or Asian students.
So final question, and I know you're also a commentator on national politics. We see you doing that on MSNBC.
I may be doing it tonight.
And the most, probably the most, you know, single distinguishing moment of this presidential campaign so far was the Kamala Harris, Joe Biden moment.
Yes.
On this exact issue.
Exactly.
Does the solution need to be national? Can it come from the mayor or the chancellor? And again, these, your task force is just advisory. The mayor and the chancellor have not adopted these proposals, and maybe they're being too timid. But does it need to be national?
I think the movement for improving public education absolutely needs to be national, and what we've had is a race to the bottom, not a race to the top. At the same time, we have seen local school districts innovating and advancing educational opportunity, including more advanced learning for more students, and in ways where students are much happier, and parents are too, because they're seeing the gains for their students. We can do that in New York City without the national government doing a thing. We can do some of that without the state doing a thing. So the call to our leadership should be to invite us into a conversation about innovation and about serving all our kids. And that's the conversation we want to participate in.
Maya Wiley from the New School and co-chair of the School Diversity Advisory Group's Executive Committee and an NBC News and MSNBC legal analyst. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.